Welcome to the podcast of Hemisphere, the official journal of the European Hematology Association. Hemisphere's podcast presents insightful, expert discussions about recent hematology publications. We hope you enjoy.
Minimal or measurable residual disease, also known as MRD, is used to help risk stratify patients and guide treatment decisions. So what if machine learning could take out some of the guesswork of MRD detection? Because now we're able to train models that can analyze thousands of cells per second and can deliver a consistent and objective readout of MRD. Hello, and welcome to the Hemisphere podcast. My name is Charles De Bock, and I'm your host. In this episode, I am joined by Tim Mocking, lead author of a new review article on how machine learning and computational approaches can indeed improve MRD detection and analysis, especially for AML patients. And remember, you can always catch more insightful discussions about new papers and emerging topics by following us and subscribing to the Hemisphere podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Thank you for joining us.
Hello and welcome to the Hemisphere podcast. My name is Charles De Bock and I'm your host. Minimal or measurable residual disease assessment in acute lymphoblastic leukemia has really revolutionized treatment stratification. And this is usually carried out using either flow cytometry or PCR-based methods looking at IGR-TCR rearrangements. When it comes to AML, however, MRD assessment can be more difficult and challenging because there really aren't any universal markers for flow cytometry-based applications to really distinguish between the normal cells and the leukemic blasts at the end of, say, induction chemotherapy. But as we know, in a world being dominated by AI and what that means, and machine learning, can these approaches offer an improved or more efficient way to assess AML-MRD? And so to discuss this a bit further, I am very delighted to be joined by Tim Mocking from the Amsterdam UMC in the Netherlands to discuss his recent review, now published in Hemisphere, which is entitled Applications of Machine Learning for Immunophenotypic Measurable Residual Disease Assessment in Acute Myeloid Leukemia. So welcome to the podcast, Tim. And for our listeners, just a bit of a primer, Tim is finishing his PhD in this topic, and so it's really a great example of that, you know, a PhD student can also publish with Hemisphere as part of their candidature. So I'm going to get right into it. I have mentioned already that assessing MRD and AML can be challenging. And so perhaps the first thing we should probably do is expand on why this is based on your review and outlining some of those challenges in the clinic and being able to accurately assess MRD and why you think machine learning can perhaps overcome some of those challenges.
Yeah, so thank you for having me, first of all. I think the challenges of flow for AML, like you said, it's mostly related to the lack of a universal marker for the AML cells. As you mentioned as well, there are also molecular techniques like qPCR, NGS that really look at these specific targets, so they can be very sensitive. But I think flow is pretty much widely applicable. I would say 80% of patients or more can be followed and monitored using flow MRD. But that's quite difficult compared to the molecular methods, because if you run, for example, an NGS for a specific mutation, you can quite easily quantify the level of MRD based on the number of mutated reads that you get in your sequencing experiment. For flow, it's a bit more difficult because the output data is just different cells and the expression levels of different markers on these cells. So you have to come up with a way to identify the leukemic cells. And anyone that has worked with flow cytometry data in before knows that you have to do this very complicated gating procedure where you look at these two-dimensional plots and you try to circle the cells that are leukemic. That is really difficult for AML. Because it's known as a very heterogeneous disease. And because of that, you need a lot of background expertise to differentiate between a normal bone marrow and a leukemic bone marrow. And I think in our institute, it takes up more than a year of training before you are able to identify the leukemic cells with accuracy in the MRD setting. And even at that point, it's really time consuming. So it can take up half an hour to an hour or more for a single analysis. And even then, it's often checked in a team of experts to form a consensus on what the leukemic cells actually are. And also, by nature, I think because it's done by hand, it's it adds a subjective element into the analysis that you don't want to have, of course, in your clinical settings. I think the subjectivity, so the differences between operators, can be mitigated a bit by standardization. But even internationally, people have different strategies to look at the same data. And if you're running a large clinical trial, you, of course, don't want any of that variability in there. The machine learning methods, they look at the data in an objective manner. And because of that, you always get exactly the same output. And I think that is the biggest benefit of using machine learning methods for this.
Yep. Yeah, because just to go over those points, the variability, not only within the institute, but across institutes, also, yeah. I'm assuming as well, the type of flow cytometer machine that you've got is going to increase variability, whether you've had it maintained regularly. I'm guessing there will be like NATA or NADA accreditation where you have to have in clinical labs. But still, as you say, you know, the subjectivity between operators, between institutes will be great. And when you're talking about very rare populations of cells, you want to be quite confident in saying, okay, this is going to change treatment, you know, therapeutic decisions from the hematologist, of course. So you want to be sure. So I can imagine that's really the bottleneck there. And not alone, you know, we're not mentioning the time that it takes for multiple operators. So, okay, the future, machine learning. But like me, I am not a machine learning expert. In fact, when I hear machine learning, and it's in a lot of literature, I'm thinking AI, but AI can be ChatGPT, which is large language models, which is probably similar or same. So maybe we can, for the benefit of our listeners, what do you define machine learning as, and how does this relate to AI as we would commonly perhaps use it if we're using Copilot, Claude, etc. AI? Is there any similarities? And perhaps you can help us understand what you mean by machine learning.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I think there's a bit of overlap between the different terms, and they are used in different ways. So there's not really a consensus definition on what machine learning or AI is. So I would say AI is very broadly using an automated system to do something that normally requires human intelligence. And the machine learning is kind of a subset of AI, where you really use data to teach the system how to perform this task. In practice, it differs a bit. I think AI are a bit more associated with like these deep learning models, like you mentioned, the ChatGPT, but even very simple models can also be understood as a type of AI, although it's not that common in practice.
Okay, so I'm glad we've got a human element. We have to teach the machine what to do, which is pretty good. Actually, in your review, you talk about the different types of teaching. You mentioned such terms as supervised, unsupervised, and novelty detection. So again, perhaps, you know, when it comes to machine learning, when you were doing this review, what do these mean in plain language? And what are the strengths and weaknesses of these approaches when it comes to teaching the algorithm to say, this is a leukemic blast and this is a normal cell, et cetera, like to get rid of this heterogeneity, if you will?
Yeah. So I think the most common application of machine learning for flow cytometry data is something that we call unsupervised learning. Of course, if you look at the flow data, you want to identify cell populations. And what most unsupervised learning methods do is they try to learn a pattern from the data without any human input. So for example, the most common thing for flow cytometry data is clustering, where you just have all of your cells on a big pile, and the machine tries to identify different clusters of cells in the data. And normally for flow cytometry data, those correspond to cell populations. So that's really a type of learning that is performed without any human elements. But the downside of it is that this doesn't really work that well for rare cells. So it's something that you mentioned. In the MRD setting, these cells are really, really rare, like 0.1% of the white blood cells as a cutoff is already MRD positive. So those patients have a higher risk of relapse, but that can be a very small amount of cells, especially for a computer. So that's one of the downsides of those unsupervised methods. You also have supervised learning. So then you have your cells and you also have a sort of annotation or labeling that you yourself made, which cell is which. And you can then teach an algorithm to replicate or learn from these labels and link them to the cells. That works really well for these rare cells, but AML has a lot of different phenotypes. So to teach an AML about all of these different patterns, you probably need hundreds to thousands of examples. We might be able to do that in our center because we perform a centralized flow assessment here, but for smaller clinical centers, that's really not possible, I think. And like you mentioned, there's another alternative, this novelty detection, which I think theoretically is a form of semi-supervised learning. So then you do have some labeling, but only for one type of your data. So in our case, that could be a normal bone marrow. So you know what normal is, and then the computer tries to identify which cells don't look like a normal cell. So then it's sort of a middle ground between supervised and unsupervised.
Okay. So in your review, you looked at, I think I counted 20 different types of machine learning studies. In fact, I even looked at the year in which they were published, and most of them were published in the last 2 years. So, you know, like an exponential rise in the number of algorithms and machine learning ways to try and look at this topic in terms of how to train these algorithms to look at these rare cells. What are the differences and what are the challenges that they're all trying to overcome? And I guess for you personally, you know, as I said, you were doing your PhD. What motivated you to do this review? And when you're looking into it, you know, were there any surprises when you went, oh, okay, here's a really old method, for example, or a new method, which was really, this is the gold standard, or maybe you can tell us a bit more about your journey into this field.
Yeah. So I think, like you mentioned, it has a longer history. So I started in sort of chronological order. And first, we wanted to look at MRD more broadly for all types of leukemias, but also in my own projects, I talked to different people and I observed that a lot of people were actually working on this already 5 or 10 years ago. And if I talked to them in person at conferences, they just said like, yeah, we're not going to do it anymore. They just gave up at some point because it was too difficult. And you don't really see that happening, for example, for CLL or other fields. So then we thought, okay, there is something that is specific to the MRD assessment in AML that makes it so challenging for a computational method to automate. And of course, we have our biological background on AML, so that made a lot of sense. So then we really started focusing the review on the challenges of AML specifically. And you do see in DC that in the last couple of years, there's an increasing attention for the topic. And I think it makes a lot of sense if you look at the type of flow cytometry data that will be generated in the near future. It's almost impossible to do the type of analysis without any sort of computational method behind it. So I think that's largely explains that there's increasingly more attention going towards this topic.
Okay. Are you actually programming as well? Is that part of your PhD candidature? You're actually doing your own MRD AML algorithm?
Yeah, I'm a bioinformatician by training, but also a biomedical scientist. So I'm a bit in the middle that I at least can understand a bit of the biology, but also am programming these algorithms myself.
Okay. So you're about to generate your very own best one. So the field has to look out. That's number 21 on the list. Perhaps. Okay.
No, it's already published. It's also
it's already published. Okay. Very good. Well, congratulations.
That is something that also came up during, it sort of evolved together with the review process that we also started forming our own opinion on this matter. So I think there's a slightly opinionated tone in the review when it comes to unsupervised methods and supervised methods that have really crucial limitations, I would say. Whereas we ourselves are a bit more fan of this semi-supervised or novelty detection kind of approach.
To be honest, when it comes to reviews, I actually prefer when the authors have a bit of opinion because it adds a bit of flavor to the review and tells me, okay, where is that field going? What do they think? And then obviously other authors can argue that in the literature. So rather than a catalogue of all the facts. I think it's really important that what you've done as well is you've said, okay, here are them, here are the weaknesses, here are the things which don't work so well, because that's how we move forward as a field in this space. So I know it's a really nice part of your review. So congratulations on that. But of course, the difficult part, which I'm going to ask you about, is when it comes to implementation of any computational-based method, which, as you will argue, will reduce variability, improve uniformity between institutes, it's actually, you know, accuracy will improve. But there's still a human element, right? A human has to take the bone marrow aspirate. They have to stain the cells. They have to run the flow cytometer. And we often say, okay, rubbish in, rubbish out, right? Whatever you put in, you know, that might, you know, there's no way you can improve that. So if the input data is flawed, or the sample is mostly dead or stained poorly, low quality, then can the algorithm, irrespective of which one, can that somehow, like, at least identify that as a sample being, you know, poor quality and needs to be redone? Or, you know, part of the whole pipeline has to be, okay, the algorithm is one section, but you really need to also standardize the front half, which is the aspirate, or can the algorithm overcome any of the human flaws, if you will? What do you think about that part?
Yeah, I think this data quality issue is often overlooked as well when people start developing these methods. They are often asked by hematologists or someone that has, like, okay, we have MRD data now for 100 patients. Let's make a method. It turns out there's all kinds of batch effects or technical yes. anomalies that have gone wrong through the experiments. So I think a large part of that can be overcome with very good standardization in the flow cytometry assays. And I think in our institutes, we have a quite high quality of data that we were able to use for our own methods. But even then, sometimes you see that different things can happen, that cells are not lysing very well, or there's some antibody titration error. I think all of the algorithms that we looked at, they don't have any inherent way to look at that type of error. So I think you need another algorithm that can sort of screen which samples are actually fit for this computational analysis. I think for most types of data that have some error in them, you can still analyze them manually. That's usually fine, but these computational methods, they can struggle with that. So we're also working on our own methods that can actually assess whether a computational method is suitable for this sample.
That's good to know, because as you say, if we can at least flag those samples and say, this one here is suitable, we can streamline those processes, then ask the question as well, okay, why was that sample not good? Was it the operator? Was it because it was done on a Tuesday in the afternoon, or was late at night, et cetera, or the first run of the day, and you can start to then look at those processes, which is kind of cool. Also, it's nice that the computer won't do everything for you unless you automate, right? There's still, you know, a nice thing that we've got human in the equations, if you will. So the other thing, of course, when it comes to computation, is that change and adoption of methods is always challenging, especially in medicine, because people are creatures of habit. And even in the face of overwhelming evidence, you know, they will resist taking on new tools. And this is perhaps exacerbated by the fact that, you know, you're asking people to trust an algorithm like AI. And, you know, chances are the doctor or hematologist won't actually understand the inner workings of that algorithm. So you're asking a lot in a way. And in fact, in 2023, we had a podcast where the authors from Spain had a great new method on machine learning technique to improve risk stratification for myelofibrosis. And they actually had two challenges. One, to find reviewers for their paper, because not many people knew about machine learning, so we can discuss that. But also then convincing hematologists to say, hey, this is great. Utility of this approach will help you overcome this bottleneck and give you more confidence in your stratification. So, you know, you said you talked to some hematologists about the bottlenecks and how the algorithms. What do you think is going to change the tide, or there's an increasing appetite, especially with AI like ChatGPT? We're kind of now used to that in our daily lives. Is that helping to persuade hematologists that, look, this is not the answer, but another tool that you can use and rely? Like, what do you think? And this is, of course, not taking into account that you need regulatory approval, right? So I know that you mentioned that in your review as well, but let's just say the human element. Is there suddenly a shift in the way this might be implemented?
Yeah, I think overall the times are indeed changing when it comes to this, the sort of the viewpoints that are on AI. I think people were really skeptical at first. They now seem to realize a lot of possibilities more. Myself, more of an advocate of just let the data speak for itself. So we're also now going to publish some data where we really, for our own methodology, do a retrospective analysis, manual gating versus computational methods, and then looking at the patient outcomes. And the results are really promising. And I think when people see that these computational methods can be implemented and might even improve the relapse prediction of patients, then it will be increasingly hard to argue against implementing something like that. But of course, that's a long road still with regulatory approval and all of that before it actually gets implemented.
So you think that even with overwhelming evidence, the hematologists themselves will go, yes, we trust this now. We don't want to be the person in the room doing the manual adjustments. You think that will be sufficient?
I think the first step will be sort of a hybrid situation. A lot of the reports that we looked at in our review are actually more of a computer-assisted methodology where the computer highlights certain leukemic cells, and then you can yourself go along with that. But you can also perform your own analysis on the side and then compare. I think that's the most, it faces the least barriers. It might not be the most time efficient way. So that's, of course, a large part of this problem is the time that it takes to do the analysis. But yeah, I think this is the first step, this computer assisted approach that you can maybe identify some false negatives or some false positives, maybe. And improve the analysis from that side, but not completely automate it 100% from the beginning.
Yeah. Okay. So when we come to computational power, how easy is it to roll this out to different clinical hematological labs and analyzing? Do we need a lot of intensive computing power, or is this something you can run on a desktop if it was implemented in the future?
So I think the biggest problem for computational power lies more with the supervised models. Like the deep learning ones, but then the problem lies more with the training of the algorithms. So if you want to train these algorithms, you really need a high performance computing environment. But once they're trained, they're actually really, really fast. For unsupervised methods, I think that has been a problem in the past, that you perform this clustering task and on a simple laptop, that might run into some issues. But even there have been advancements in the algorithms, but also from the hardware side, that are making a lot of these issues disappear over the years. So I'm optimistic when it comes to the computational aspect of it.
Excellent. Traditional flow cytometry, and you mentioned also spectral flow cytometry, which is gaining more and more traction, which, well, in a way, also increases the complexity of the data because we've got way more immunophenotypic markers that we can add to the staining pool. And how will that influence the machine learning and, again, the computational approach to MRD? Is this going to be something which pushes the field even further forward, or what are your thoughts on spectral flow?
So I think, like I said, the analysis already takes half an hour or more for our 4x8 markers that we look right now in the clinic. If you're looking at these spectral panels, they have 20, 30, 40 markers. So I think the computational aspects or the manual gating aspect will be overwhelming, and it will become an absolute necessity to have some computational approach. And I think that largely explains why an increasing amount of attention is going towards this topic in recent years. There's one thing that I like to mention, which I find myself very interesting for the spectral cytometry data. We know AML is a very heterogeneous disease when it's comes with different patients, but also within the same bone marrow, you can have different subclones of the disease. And I hope that the spectral data can also give some more information on that type of the data. And I think that is very hard to do with this manual gating procedure, but the computational aspects can also look at these different heterogeneous expression patterns and maybe also related to clinical questions.
Excellent. So what's next in the machine learning field for you personally? Like you said, you're at the end of your PhD, that you're wrapping up. Where do you see the field going from here? And where would you like to see it go as well?
Yeah. So we have our methods now published. So that is really nice. And we're going to publish our retrospective validation on 400 AML patients in the near future. But even then, it's still localized within our own center. We are a centralized lab, so we have the luxury of having all this data. I think the next step is also to look at a sort of multi-center setting, algorithms that can be set up in different centers, or maybe centers with the same panels can collaborate to obtain more training data. I think that is a very interesting aspect. But also, once these methods start maturing, you, of course, also want to look at prospective studies. And I think I'm a bit worried when it comes to those studies. We know that MRD is also implemented a lot of times before it's actually randomized or assessed in a randomized trial that's happening right now. But that has given us also a lot of difficulties to look at the manual gating aspect, but it also will occur for computational methods because they are so similar. And also most of the clinical trials that are going to be starting are all going to be looking at targeted therapies like menin inhibitors, venetoclax therapies, where we don't also really know the effect on the phenotypic shifts that might occur. Yes. So if we're going to look at prospective studies, that's going to be a bit difficult once we start moving away from standard intensive chemo.
Yeah, those targeted therapies, which will become more frontline. And then if they do cause differentiation, your markers will be all over the place and you won't be able to track them.
Yeah.
Fortunately, we're saying that, do we see an end to flow cytometry? And we mentioned at the very beginning, NGS space, those costs are kind of high and probably a barrier to rolling out for most labs. Do you think flow cytometry will continue to have a place if NGS costs come down, or NGS, just the time it takes to do the sequencing will always be, you know, flow is so immediate that that's the advantage? Or, well, again, maybe it's a hybrid where you have to have both. You have, okay, here's the initial one, then we do the NGS as well to confirm. Or what are your thoughts on the role of NGS versus flow for MRD?
Yeah, I think the promise for NGS that there are still a lot of markers that have to be validated and can be validated in the future. The sequencing costs for a long time have gone down substantially, of course, but even there you will reach a plateau, I think, where the costs are mostly related to the personnel, the machines, and also the turnover time is, of course, a very big part of it. But flow cytometry is, of course, also evolving at the same time with these spectral panels. And I think the implementation is really accelerating at this point for flow as well, because we are validating these different panels that can be evaluated in a standardized way. We don't have to argue that much about which markers are in the panels, which was a very a very big debate for many years. And with spectral, we don't have to worry about that much anymore, because everybody can have their own little marker in the panel.
yes, true.
So I think that that looks promising.
Excellent. Okay, well, that was a very, very fantastic, thorough conversation and discussion about your review. And it's a wonderful paper. So accessible, which is always great for those of us who don't know much about machine learning. So congratulations on a wonderful review. I wish you all the best for the last part of your PhD. And, you know, like I said, it's a great example for our listeners who might also be PhDs to consider Hemisphere as a place to consider publishing their work as well, be it the primary research, clinical research, or even a review. Thank you once again for a great conversation and all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hemisphere podcast. All of Hemisphere's content is open access and can be found at www.hemispherejournal.com. We hope you will join us for future podcast episodes.